The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. So, tonight I want to speak about a list, one of the many lists that we have in the Dharma, and this one is called the Five Faculties. So it is said in the discourses that somebody who deeply understands the five faculties is headed and propelled towards liberation. So it's a good list to understand and practice. Now, what are the five spiritual faculties? They're faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So we think about faculty as an inherent mental or physical power. So I guess people outside can't hear. It's also a capability, a capacity, or facility. And as such, this is something that we can cultivate. So I want to start by giving you just an overview of the five faculty and how naturally they arise one from the other. If we begin by thinking about what brought us, all of us, here, I would say that for a lot of us, some kind of dissatisfaction in our lives brought us here. Maybe for others, some curiosity. Many come one time, a second time, and that's enough. It's not for everyone. But those of us who continue coming, it's because we experience in ourselves that this practice is in some way beneficial. When I first started coming to IMC, I was in the midst of a lot of stress. I was a mom of a young child, and I was in the PhD program, so I felt like I had a lot of weight on my shoulders. And I noticed that coming here would center me. I'd love to come Monday nights. That was my night. And inevitably, I felt when I left more settled, more at peace. So little by little, I developed faith. Faith in this practice. And I was willing to put in the effort of coming regularly and even at some point of meditating daily. So you can see already how the second faculty of effort flows naturally out of faith. So once I was making the effort of meditating regularly, it made sense for me to apply this effort into making mindfulness happen in my meditation sessions. And then also in my daily chores. So in meditation, when I managed to steady my mind long periods of time through mindfulness, something interesting started to happen, and it's as if all the strands of your many thoughts, distractions, start to gather, and then concentration happens. And concentration is the fourth faculty. So finally, I began to notice that thanks to faith and the ongoing effort, mindfulness, and concentration, I was having or beginning to have insights into new aspects of myself and my life. And this resulted in gradually some wisdom increasing, wisdom being the last faculty. So you see that there's is really quite some logic to how one faculty arises from the other. So now I want to take one faculty at a time and look at it a little bit closer. So starting with the first one, faith. The word in Pali for faith is sada. And sada is mainly translated as faith, but it's important to keep in mind that it also, sada has the meaning of trust and confidence. So I grew up as Catholic, and in my early 20s, I realized that faith was not something I was terribly comfortable with. I wasn't comfortable with it because of its association with blind faith to creed and doctrines. So many years later, in the Dharma, I learned how faith is something that requires us to be active. Faith is something that we arrive to after we have verified for ourselves the teachings. So it is all about arriving to trust and confidence after we have tested the teachings in us. I find this very, very satisfying. So I was stressed, and coming here regularly, meditating, listening to Dharma, and applying it to my life as best as I could, it gave me well-being and ease. And so gradually, I have developed verified faith. I like this term of verified faith, and I find that it is really quite interesting that in Pali we actually have a term, one word, for verified faith, and that's pasada. So to me, it says already a lot about the practice that there is one word to express this aspect of verified faith. So when we talk about faith, trust, confidence in Buddhism, is in what are we supposed to have faith, trust, confidence? First and foremost, we want to develop trust and confidence in ourselves. So in Buddhism, we are encouraged to cultivate trust and confidence in our capacity for inner peace, and also innate wisdom. When we have found inner trust, we depend less and less in outer situations to be in a particular way. And this turns makes us in a much more confident person. So as we cultivate faith in us, we want to learn to be careful that faith doesn't get, as Gill says, too fervent, blind, or gushy. But rather, we want it to be a simple, tranquil faith. Simple, tranquil faith. So in the discourses, we read over and over again how the Buddha's disciples had full trust and confidence in him. Now, we don't have the Buddha. So who do we give our trust to? We have teachers and the Buddha's teachings. For us, we can say that we begin by giving teachers a provisional or conditional trust. And through time, if the teacher proves to teach and live with integrity, then our trust and confidence in him or her can grow gradually. We always keep in mind, though, that the teacher is human, and we don't idealize and have blind faith in the teacher. I respect that very much in this tradition, how we hold the role of the teacher. So we can also develop faith and trust and confidence in the teachings. The best way to do this is trying out the teachings out for ourselves, noticing how the Dharma invites us to view life from a new perspective and how it frees us from unnecessary burdens. Understanding that the trust in the Dharma, as with the teacher, is something that develops gradually. Now, one of the things that can give us the most reliable trust or unshakable faith in Buddhism is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Just the plain fact, acceptance, without feeling victims, that there is suffering in the world, that there are causes of suffering, that the end of suffering is possible, and that there is a path to the end of suffering. You know, the path being the Noble Eightfold Path. That in itself is a whole path towards liberation. It's the nugget of this practice. So when we don't have faith, trust, or confidence in this practice, every single step in the path is very effortful. I have the image of having this drag wind against us, and it's so difficult to make progress. So that's as far as faith. And now going on to the second faculty, effort. So as I mentioned before, if we are willing to make effort in this practice, once we have trust and confidence in this path, we feel, yes, I'm willing to make this effort. I know this is the correct path for me. So in this context of the five faculties, when we talk about effort, effort for what? Effort to do what? So effort here refers to arousing energy to be aware of what's going on in our minds at all times if possible. Or I like to think of it as being aware of the ecology of our minds. And in essence, what that amounts to is that we make effort to abandon unwholesome states and acquire and cultivate the wholesome states. So I'll read you a quote from the discourses. He, she is strong, firm in exertion, not shirking responsibility of cultivating wholesome states. This is called the faculty of energy. Now, I find it very interesting that they use the word responsibility. It's actually very, very positive to know that it is up to us. We are responsible for this ecology in our minds. We can have an influence of what goes on in our minds. So this abandoning unwholesome states and acquiring and cultivating wholesome states gets expressed in a four-part formula that is called the Four Right Strivings. So here is a little list within the list, as is so typical in Buddhism. So the first of these strivings, we want to guard unwholesome states from arising. Yeah? We want to be watchful. So this implies being aware when unwholesome states are not present. Well, it's also important Right now, there are no unwholesome states present. Whenever we can, we consciously avoid the conditions that result in unwholesome states. Yeah, so be aware, what is it in your life that brings about the unwholesome states? You watch a violent movie, what happens in your mind afterwards? You know, so we avoid those activities that bring about unwholesome states. In my own case, I notice that when I'm tired, I have to be especially watchful. When I'm tired, it's like from this back corner that I can't, this blind spot, this some thought that's not quite so unwholesome can creep in. And so the image that I like to keep in mind guarding is to become an alert, wise gatekeeper. We are watching very carefully at the mind's gate, what presents itself, and with we bring energy to just not allow past the gate, the city's walls, something unwholesome. Nope. So that's enough of the first right striving. The second right striving is abandoning the arisen of wholesome states. So what happens is that for most of us, we don't notice when the unwholesome state begins. We notice when it's been there already for a while. So once it's there, of course, we want to become conscious. Okay, an unwholesome mind state is present, and not to judge. So a couple times we are able to see how the unwholesome state begins to arise, and that gives us a better chance of just saying no, you know. But sometimes it's not easy to, even if we see it arise, we are not able to free ourselves from it. And when that happens, we got to bring about some self-compassion. That means there's still some emotional connection to whatever is going on. We are not able to let go of it. And we're just aware of that. The third right striving. Now we go into the wholesome ones. This is encouraging unarisen wholesome states to arise. So here I think the main task is that we want to cultivate wholesome conditions. You know, what brings about these wholesome states? So cultivating wholesome conditions such as meditating regularly, guarding the sense doors, wise caring for our bodies, living a simple life, not too busy if possible, meaningful activities, practicing generosity, and cultivating wise friends. All of this will bring about the arising of wholesome states. And the fourth and last one of the right striving is the maintenance of arisen wholesome states. So you're also being aware and appreciative of their presence, when they're present. And being also aware of what brought about the wholesome state. We want to cultivate those conditions that brought them about. So summarizing this second faculty of effort, it is about arousing energy to tend to our mental ecology. And we do that through these four right strivings. So the third faculty is mindfulness. Mindfulness is a, well, hopefully very well-known friend to all of you. Mindfulness is so central to this practice. Buddhism could not exist without mindfulness. Just very briefly, most of you are very familiar, but some of you maybe not so much. Mindfulness offers us the possibility to train our minds, to be very, very present to what is happening right now, right here. This we're all pretty familiar with, but I think often what we forget is to pay attention to the quality of the attention. So it's not only about paying attention, but what is the quality of our attention. We think about the quality that is associated with mindfulness as being kind, as being flexible, and non-judging. And so we train ourselves to diligently apply mindfulness as continuously as possible. Now listen to how mindfulness is described in the discourses. He or she is mindful, possessing supreme mindfulness and discretion. One who remembers and recollects what was done and said long ago. She dwells contemplating the body in the body, feelings in the feelings, mind in the mind, phenomena in phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. This is called the faculty of mindfulness. So the one aspect that I find interesting about using the word of discretion is that if you realize discretion is not only about acting, speaking wisely with discernment, but also when you say it's up to your discretion, we are implying a choice. And I find that interesting for mindfulness, right? Because when we are really applying mindfulness, we are giving ourselves having the freedom to take a choice in crucial moments. That we are able to see, we are able to discern, oh, this is the right thing for me to say, to do. So that's really beautiful to connect that meaning of discretion. Now there's also in that quote that I read to you the aspect of recollect what was done and said long ago. Now, I don't know about you, but I have not heard a whole lot of comments related to memory connected with mindfulness. So I found interesting looking a little bit into it. Bhikkhu Anālaya writes how this passage points to two kinds of memory. One is what one has done, which he calls autobiographical memory, and the other one, what one has heard, which points to how we perceive and learn. So this second kind of memory points to the ancient practice in India of communicating the Dharma orally. So how we heard, or how they heard at the time, was incredibly important. If you wanted to have the teachings accessible to you, it was very important that you were very present when you listened to the Dharma, so you could remember. You would have then the teachings accessible to you. So it's a little, looking a little bit more about memory and mindfulness. Anālaya writes that mindfulness implies an intensified and broadened form of attention given to what is occurring in the present. This enriches one's awareness of what is happening to such an extent that this strengthens one's ability to recall later what took place. So, in other words, we will only remember that which we were aware of. Now, we have a certain degree of awareness as we go about our chores. However, for awareness to be mindful, it has to be cultivated and intentional, brought about into being. So mindfulness supports us not only the ability of storing memory, but also the quality of mind that allows us to retrieve it easily. And you can see that this is already pointing to something very important, because through accessing our past experiences, we are able to practice discernment. This aspect of memory is connected to what we call in Buddhism perception. Perception, which is the ability to give names to things. So to match our experience with concepts. Now, if you've never come to a meditation hall and you see that, you might say, oh, maybe there's a ball with some candy in there and she's going to pass it around later. So you would not have the association of this ball being a bell. So that's the perception. Once you've been here, you know this is a bell, you connect it. Oh, okay, this is a bell. This is perception now connected to memory, and these are all the experiences that are now available to us for mindfulness to be able to take decisions later, not only about labeling something, but about values too. So, the last little bit of the the quote that I read to you about mindfulness: he dwells contemplating the body in the body, feelings in the feelings, mind in the mind, phenomena in phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehended. So just briefly, this is an invitation to be with our entire experience in every simple and in a very simple and direct way without getting caught in the narrative. So without adding any narrative. That's easily said, but it's, as we know, it's pretty difficult to, in the hearing, only the hearing, in the seeing, only the seeing, etc. So next time you find yourself in an emotionally loaded discussion, experiment being present, softening the body and the mind, and offer your presence rather than your opinion. And just notice what happens. Going on to the fourth faculty, concentration. And for this one, I want to share with you a simile that some of you might already know, but I find it a very charming way to explain concentration and how it functions together with effort and mindfulness. So this simile appears in the commentaries, and I've made a little adjustment. I've changed flowers for fruits, which you'll see. So imagine three boys are walking in nature. They come about this gorgeous tree with fruits. And they all try to reach for the fruit. Can't reach. So the tallest boy says, well, I have the greatest chance to reach it. So he tries again, but no luck. So the second boy says, no problem, I'll bend over, step on me, and go and see if you can reach. So the second boy bends over, the tallest boy stands on his back, tries to reach the fruit, but he's wobbling terribly. So the third boy rushes over and offers his hand to stabilize him. And guess what? The tallest boy is able to reach the fruit. So what are we dealing with here? The tallest boy is the equivalent of concentration. He's the one who brings together all the effort, all the different strands in this experience to be able to focus on the object, which is the fruit, and harvest it. The boy who offers his back That's effort. He makes allows himself to be used as a step stool. He's doing the effort so that concentration can step on him and reach the fruit. And what's going to be the third boy? Mindfulness, right? Mindfulness then becomes the stabilizing force. And if I may stretch the simile a little bit more, we can say that the fruit in the tree are the insights that we gain from our practice when we bring together effort and mindfulness and concentration. And when we do this often enough, wisdom arises. And so we get to the last faculty. Faculty 5, wisdom, gets expressed in a way that I find very graphic. I want you to imagine a peaked roof, and you know how the rafters come together in the center. So in the center, we have what we call the ridge beam. And that's what this simile points towards, the function of wisdom. So it's the converging point of the rafters. They all come together to this ridge beam. Within the five faculty, then, functions as the converging point and stabilizers of faith, of effort, of energy. Effort or energy is the same, mindfulness and concentration. Now, within the Dharma, what does it imply to be wise? A wise person has had the insight into the nature of impermanence. One knows it not just intellectually, but has had a deep understanding of what impermanence is, such as coming up against death, feeling the grief, the pain of the loss of a loved one, and being confronted with our own mortality, having health one day and not having it the next day, having a happy marriage and seeing it fall apart in front of our face. So I could go on and on of all the things that can change any time for us, sometimes for the good, not always for the bad, but change is inevitable. So a person that is embodying wisdom and is confronted with these very challenging changes, losses, won't rant and rage about the losses. He or she will allow the pain in while having unshakable faith in the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. So here's how it is expressed in the discourses. He possesses wisdom directed to arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative, leading to the complete destruction of suffering. He understands as it really is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called the faculty of wisdom. So I will end by reading a passage from the Dhammapada, the teachings that are written in verse. Irrigators guide water, fletchers shape arrows, carpenters fashion wood, sages tame themselves. So I would like to say that a sage tames himself or herself when he or she has learned to embody the five faculties: faith and effort and mindfulness and concentration and wisdom. So let's take a few minutes to be quiet. I'm just letting the many, many words settle. So thank you very much. And we have a few minutes, so if anybody has a comment or a question, or otherwise we can leave a couple minutes earlier. Nobody? Yes, can you pass the microphone? Well, you know, because it's recorded, if you don't use the mic, the person then listening can't hear what the person asks.
Thank you. Very nice.
You're welcome.
Great talk. I wonder about the effort point.
Mm-hmm.
Efforts. I wonder if this is true, that too many efforts.
Ah, yes.
Obstacle in this path. It's depending on your job, I guess. You know, some role in life. You know.
Yes. Thank you for that comment. It's an excellent point, and it's something that it's very important in our practice to work with effort. You know, like a chemist, just you always kind of being super precise. Is how much is too much? The moment that you start to over effort, that and there is tension. You've gone too far, right? So we want to. It's like when you're meditating, right? If you let yourself be too kind of relaxed, you go to sleep. So you want to bring a little bit of effort, but not enough to get yourself all tensed up. And you kind of learn, you know, for me, the best way to measure that is in your body. The body will tell you when you are, you know, you're cranking up the heat too much, the insides of your body start to tense up. So pay attention to the body. The body remains soft. Then, you know, soft and the mind is not going to sleep, then you have the right balance. Does it make sense? Or is there another part that it looks like there you still have a bit of a doubt?
Yes, because the Chirana scientist and this whole sometimes in some periods you don't give 120%.
You don't what?
You know, sometimes to make certain job and make it on time.
Mm-hmm.
This is the reality today that you have to push. Even if you are tired, even if it's, you know, long day.
Yeah, okay. I hear you.
And you also know that it's a meaningful. It is also meaningful. So many jobs are meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah, so
I feel like it's an urgent stuff to address these questions, not because of your ego. I'm not talking about this part, but
yeah. You know what I was referring to was definitely within the practice, but you know we all know that in our daily lives we have deadlines and we have to perform and it produces stress, and so that's a different kind of a situation. However, we can't. For a long time, for me, as I was doing academic work, I would get a little bit too leaning forward. And as I got more and more into the practice, I realized, you know, I can actually be quite efficient by sitting back, softening my body, and allowing the mind to just take in. If you manage to be with your body relaxed and your mind settled, you are so much productive than if you're completely revved up and you're having to repeat things over and over because you're a little bit agitated. So we know that an agitated mind is not very efficient, right? So experiment with that. It's not something that you are going to get changed in 1 month. It's something that happens gradually. But try it, because it really brings so much more ease and well-being and efficiency, too.
So can I?
Yeah, we'll have to be brief. We have 1 minute, but sure.
So you were talking about practice.
Yeah.
And I took it to the entire life.
Uh-huh, like, yeah.
Because when you talk about faith, you talked about the faith in this practice.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But I thought that it's faith in the path.
Yeah,
path,
well,
of
you know, ideally
right?
We want to bring these faculties, of course, to all of our lives. But, you know, we just need to know that these faculties function differently when we're meditating. We start by really practicing the mindfulness in the meditation, and then we bring it out to the other activities. Because it's easier, right? When you're meditating, you're able to really focus a bit more. When you're doing all kinds of other things, you're juggling many inputs, right? So, okay. Have a very good evening. Thank you.